Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Josh Frydenberg makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's always been a very good supporter of ours, and we're very happy to have him back. And thanks also to King and Wood Mellicent for the use of this fine facility. I'll introduce our speaker briefly, because he's very well known. He was educated at Monash University with degrees in arts and economics, and studied and took degrees at Oxford and Harvard. He was a lawyer for Mellicent's for a time, worked for Deutsche Bank, for John Howard as Prime Minister, for Alexander Downer as Foreign Minister. He held a number of senior positions. After winning the seat of Kooyong in 2010, Robert Menzies' seat, he held senior positions in opposition and later in government. But more recently, Josh Frydenberg is here tonight as the Minister of Resources, Energy and Northern Australia, and talking on the topic, the importance of energy and resources, of the energy and resources sector to the Australian economy and the challenges which lie ahead. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gerard, and I see lots of familiar faces here, and good to see Dick Walcott, a good friend and a wonderful Australian, and John Kunkel and many others. After being on last night's right-wing talk show, Q&A, it's good to be here in a friendly audience, so thank you very much. To Gerard and Anne and to the Institute, you play an absolute wonderful role in driving important public policy debates in this country. You do it in a impartial and bipartisan way, in a rigorous analytical way, and at the same time you're constant commentators in our press, and in Anne's case, some significant books to her names. Okay, Menzies' Child was a good one too, but I had the great privilege of launching Anne's book, Menzies at War, which was a very important book. And if I think about the resources sector and I think about that agreement Sir Robert Menzies inked with the Japanese Prime Minister back in 1957, the Japan-Australia Economic Partnership, that has very much laid the foundation for the very strong resources development that we've had in our country since. Can I also thank King and Wood and Mallison's for the hospitality today. I am an alumni, and it's very nice to be back. Tonight I want to make 3 points in talking about the importance of the resources and energy sector to the Australian economy and riding the waves of volatility and the challenges ahead. First is the importance of the sector to our economy, and the important role that we play in global energy security and alleviating energy poverty. Second point I want to make is that despite the current volatility in international markets and heightened pessimism about the global economy, Australia should be optimistic about our future and our capacity to innovate and seize the opportunities. And thirdly, I will highlight areas in need of attention, in particular the application of geoscience technology to exploration and development, and the need for greater labour market flexibility. These government-led reforms, together with the industry's own effort, will ensure that the resources sector remains a stable and reliable supplier of high-quality resources extracted at the low end of the global cost curve. Australia has a remarkable story to tell. we are in our 25th year of consecutive economic growth. Having survived the dot-com boom and bust, the Asian financial crisis, and the global financial crisis. This record of consecutive years of economic growth has only been surpassed by one other country in the developed world, namely the Netherlands, who had 26 years, which ended in 2008. And we are on track to break that record. Our rich endowment of natural resources, combined with our strong and stable institutions and the drive of private enterprise, has been integral to this economic success story. Today, resources and energy represent around 10% of our GDP, are responsible for more than half of our exports, and employ over 300,000 Australians. As a sector, mining pays the highest wages, employs the largest number of skilled workers such as engineers, and has the highest proportion of Indigenous Australian employees. Australia is the world's largest exporter of both iron ore and coal. And by the end of this decade, we are expected to overtake Qatar to be the world's largest exporter of liquefied natural gas. Australia is also the second largest exporter of gold and zinc, the third largest exporter of nickel, and the fourth largest exporter of copper. These Australian resource exports have been essential for infrastructure and economic development in emerging economies, lifting millions of people out of poverty in the process. This is not a recent development. Indeed, the resources story is synonymous with Australia's national identity. By tracing the history of mining and development in Australia, we can see how we turn from a series of struggling, underpopulated British colonies in the early 19th century to a prosperous, cohesive nation. The discovery of gold in Australia in 1851 triggered a gold rush and marked the beginning of our mining industry. The gold rush precipitated a doubling of Australia's population in less than 10 years and a quadrupling of the population in my own state of Victoria. Fast forward 150 years, and most recently Australia has been among the greatest beneficiaries of what is often called the commodity supercycle. This was driven by Chinese growth and the continued demand from our long-standing customers in Japan, Korea, and the rest of East Asia. But we have now reached the end of a decade-long supercycle, whose record prices led to around $400 billion worth of investment in Australia's production capacity in the resources and energy sector over the last decade. In February, I led a delegation of Australian energy and resource industry leaders to CERAWeek in Houston, a leading annual global energy conference. Here, a key question throughout the conference was, where will the current price volatility in the energy and resource sectors leave us? And the price of oil was at the forefront of that discussion. In just a short period of time, we've seen the oil price fall from around $140 at the peak of the boom to the current price of around $40 a barrel. Why is this so? And the answer is a complex combination of supply and demand dynamics, with the emphasis being on changes to the supply side. In the last 5 years, more than 4.2 million barrels a day have come on stream from shale oil in the United States. Saudi Arabia, which produces on average 10 million barrels of oil a day, has lifted their production by 5% in just January alone. Iran, no longer the subject of international sanctions, is producing nearly 3 million barrels a day, with the expectation that they will deliver an extra million barrels a day soon after. Nevertheless, with the resulting lower prices, we have also seen, according to the International Energy Agency, for the first time on record, 2 years of consecutive negative growth in oil exploration. This underinvestment will result in demand eventually catching up with supply and prices rising. When it comes to resource markets more broadly, the end of the super cycle is seeing a return to more normalised cyclical patterns of demand, particularly in China, as its economy transitions from investment to consumption and a greater focus on services. However, China remains central to the global resources story. It is the world's largest producer and consumer of coal, the largest consumer of iron ore and producer of steel, the second largest consumer of oil, and the third largest consumer of gas. China, importantly, is also increasing its reliance on renewables, becoming the largest investor in renewables in the world, bigger, according to the International Energy Agency, than the United States and the EU combined. And tonight I want to dispel the notion that because the Chinese economy is transitioning, that suddenly the demand for hard commodities and the subsequent export income earned from their sale will dry up. To paraphrase Mark Twain, rumours of the death of the Australian resources sector are largely exaggerated. International demand for Australian resources remains strong. Our economy remains resilient, and our companies do so too. And the depreciation of the Australian dollar has acted, in the words of our Reserve Bank governor, as an automatic stabiliser, increasing our competitiveness. The reality is that over the decades ahead, hundreds of billions of dollars will flow to Australia as both demand and supply increases. A good illustration of this dynamic is Australia's export earnings from coal and iron ore between 2011-12 and 2014-15. Despite price falls of between 43% and 57%, export earnings from these commodities fell only 16%. This reflects a lower Australian dollar and a 30% increase in coal export volumes and a 60% increase in iron ore export volumes. When it comes to the export of LNG, there is even a more powerful story to tell. Export earnings between 2011-12 and 2014-15 have increased by more than 40%. Driven by increased volumes and a lower Australian dollar, export earnings are expected to triple to nearly $49 billion by 2019-20, as we overtake Qatar as the world's largest exporter of LNG. So where is this demand coming from, and why is the Australian resources sector so resilient? First, the Chinese economy, at $11.4 trillion in US dollars, is 2.5 times bigger than it was in 2008. Interestingly, this means that a 6.8% annualised growth rate in 2015 is equivalent to 14% growth in 2007. It emphasises how important it is to avoid drawing conclusions from simplistic comparisons of annualised growth rates. Remarkably, each year, the Chinese are adding an economy, adding an economy the size of Turkey. Each year, China is adding to their economy an economy the size of Turkey. In December 2015, China imported more iron ore than ever before. Some is used for the production of steel for export, the rest for domestic use. Chinese steel exports to the emerging economies are growing, with steel exports in 2015 increasing by 26% to India and 55% to Vietnam. While China has seen rapid rates of industrialization in recent years, leading to more than 200 million people moving to the cities, 37,000 kilometres of rail track being built, and 63 million flats completed in the last decade alone, there is still a long way to go. For a country with such a large landmass and population, its rail system is just one-third of the size of that in the United States and one-sixth of that in the EU. Demand will continue to grow, providing a lot of scope for Australia's iron ore and metallurgical coal. And when it comes to energy demand, China's per capita consumption is still a third of that in the United States, an equation that the International Energy Agency predicts will change dramatically as Chinese per capita energy use increases in the years ahead. But I want to emphasise tonight that the China story is not the only game in town. Economic growth in India and Southeast Asia is driving increased demand for Australia's resource exports. In 2015, India's economy grew by 7.4% and is forecast to grow by 6.5% a year from now to 2020. On the numbers, the Indian economy will be five times bigger in 2040 than it is today. And as a result, demand for gas, for coal, for iron ore, for renewables is taking off. Consider this. Today, India has 18% of the world's population, but represents only 6% of the world's energy use. Astonishingly, India's energy use on a per capita basis is today less than that in Africa. Around 300 million Indians have little access to electricity or no access at all. And I recently had to Australia as my guest the Indian Energy Minister, Piyush Goyal, and he made it very clear that by 2022, India hopes to have all its citizens connected to the grid. India's consumption of steel is also comparatively low. On a per capita basis, it's a quarter of the global average and around one-eighth of that in China. With over 300 million Indians expected to move to the cities by 2040, demand is soon to escalate. By 2020, India is forecast to overtake China, Japan and the EU to become the largest coal importer in the world as it seeks to almost treble coal-fired power generation between now and 2040. All this is good news for Australia because contracts for our LNG from our Gorgon project to Petronet LNG have been signed and are starting to flow, and our coal exports to India, already sizable at $5 billion a year, will likely escalate and increase in the years ahead. The reality is that there will be significant demand for our energy and our minerals going forward, and this forms a basis for long-term optimism for these sectors of Australia's industry. It is the consequence of just simple arithmetic. Between 2010 and 2030, the world's population will increase by 23%, and the world's middle class will more than double. And all of this fuels the demand for hard commodities. And the biggest movements are occurring in those emerging economies right on our doorstep, putting Australia in an ideal position to capitalise. Innovation will help Australia seize these opportunities. And Australia has never rested on its laurels, and it's the ongoing supply and demand dynamic emphasises the need for a country like Australia to focus on what we can control, boosting our nation's competitiveness. We also know that we have to be innovative to seize these opportunities. Lowering trade barriers, streamlined regulatory processes, greater labour market flexibility and productivity-enhancing infrastructure projects are all important. Australian iron ore miners like BHP, Rio Tinto and Fortescue have pioneered the adoption of automation, operating drilling equipment, trucks and trains remotely from their control headquarters in Perth, 1,500 kilometres away at the Pilbara. This is helping to ensure that three quarters of Australia's iron ore production is on the bottom half of the global cost curve. The Australian coal industry is achieving 5 to 10% increases in productivity from longwall mining automation. This is a highly competitive industry with countries such as China, the United States, Indonesia, Russia, South Africa and Colombia, all major producers. In the energy sector, Australia is pioneering floating LNG platforms, which will allow the production of LNG offshore. The LNG Prelude floating platform will be more than 300,000 tonnes in weight and will be the largest offshore platform that has ever been built anywhere in the world. Companies like Woodside are using underwater autonomous vehicles at their Pluto site, and Santos has partnered with IBM to use big data analytics to predict problems on their pipelines. I recently had the privilege, just last the week before last, to visit Barrow Island off the coast of Western Australia, where Chevron has been leading the production of LNG from the Gorgon plant. The scale of this project is absolutely incredible. At $70 billion, it is the largest private sector investment ever in Australia's history. Not just the largest resources project ever, the largest private sector investment. At full capacity, an LNG tanker will load around every 2 days, and each shipment will have enough energy on board to supply around 80,000 Japanese homes for 1 year. This project has the largest subsea infrastructure that has ever been built anywhere in the world. And it also has the largest carbon capture and storage facility ever built anywhere in the world. In fact, it's three times bigger than the second biggest CCS plant that has ever been built before. At a cost of more than $2 billion, it will pump more than 2 million tonnes of CO2 into a saline formation 2 kilometres below the surface. Our comparative advantage in resources is maintained by our very high levels of investment in R&D. And this is captured in patents. A study by IP Australia found that there were more than 6,500 inventions in the mining sector between 1994 and 2011. And in a remarkable statistic, Australia produces more than 60% of the world's mining software. Australia produces more than 60% of the world's mining software. In coming years, sophisticated use of digital technology and data analytics will further drive productivity gains. And last year, Rio Tinto launched its Analytics Excellence Centre, which uses predictive mathematics, machine learning, and advanced modelling to process the huge amount of data captured by sensors, reducing maintenance costs and the incidence of unplanned breakdowns. In Jandakot, just outside of Perth, a $100 million advanced analytics and digital training and monitoring centre run by GE employs 350 people in digital technology and supports the training of next generation workers in the energy space. GE has equipment on all LNG projects operating through Australia. And through its industrial internet, it can monitor the behaviour of machinery and notify operators if a machine is behaving abnormally and therefore avoid an unplanned downtime. The National Innovation and Science Agenda highlights Australia's underperformance on research collaboration compared to other OECD countries. But companies such as Exxon and Chevron are helping to address this, establishing partnerships with Australian universities. The University of Western Australia runs on the board its self-anchoring system for floating LNG and pipeline construction has resulted in a $125 million saving in construction costs for just one company alone. In addition to these private sector-led initiatives, there is much more that the government can do to leverage off existing scientific expertise and databases to enhance the production of exploration activity. In the absence of major new discoveries, Australia's production of many minerals is likely to decline over time. And we know the reasons why Australia's exploration success has declined. It is because our early discoverable near-surface mineral deposits have already been developed. However, the great success of Australia's resource sector has been generated from just 20% of our landmass. 80% of our landmass is virtually unexplored in mineral deposits, and in these parts of Australia, it will continue to be so. So Geoscience Australia has the technical capacity to undertake geological mapping of mineral deposits both near the surface and to depths down hundreds of metres. This is a classic public good, and individual companies cannot do this mapping on a large scale. But if governments make this data available to all, the insight it provides will crowd in private sector explorers searching for the next Tier 1 deposit. And this is an issue that I am focusing on, and hopefully we can repeat some of the successes as in the past, such as in 1996, when Geoscience Australia undertook just $3 million worth of work in the Browse Basin, and the information from this facilitated the discovery of the Ichthys field, which will lead to more than $70 billion in export earnings over the next 40 years. And similar success has been achieved by federal and state agencies with their work at the Olympic Dam site and the Bight Basin. Finally, reform is critical to Australia's continued success. And ongoing economic reform is vital to seizing these opportunities. An area where there is both an opportunity and a need for reform is in the industrial relations space. Now more than ever, these Australian projects need to deliver productivity gains if they are to remain competitive. We need to leave the mindset of capital versus labour behind, as both the worker and the investor stand to gain from better productivity and encouraging more investment. As a Western Australian and the Minister responsible for employment, Michaela Cash knows this firsthand. And she will be charged with the re-establishment of the Australian Building and Construction Commission, which is vitally important to the resources sector, and so too are reforms to union right of entry rules and greenfield agreements. The Prime Minister has demonstrated his commitment to these vital reform areas by recalling the Parliament to specifically pass the ABCC Bill in April. And with regard to the right of entry, it is our policy to restore some balance to a process which has seen unions exploit the law to make, in some cases, hundreds of site visits over a short period of time. Reducing the frequency of visits by union officials to premises where they have no members or they are not invited to send a representative would be a positive step forward. And with respect to greenfield sites, the Parliament, with the assistance of the members on the crossbench, did pass important legislation last November which allowed employers to go to the Fair Work Commission after a six-month negotiation period had passed without agreement between them and the union. This was an important amendment that will prevent negotiating tactics dragging out indefinitely. However, a further matter important to the resources sector which has been raised with me relates to extending the duration of the greenfield agreements to the duration of the construction period of the particular project. Otherwise, you have a situation, like we've seen at Gorgon, where the completion of billions of dollars worth of investment can be delayed while protracted and difficult negotiations take place. This is an additional and unnecessary risk that companies have to factor in to their investment decisions in Australia, and it does deserve further legislative attention. In conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, the Australian resources and energy sector has been here before. Peaks and troughs are part of a cycle reflecting complex supply and demand dynamics. This is a long-term business, and I'm very proud of the role that Australia plays. The good news, though, is that Australia has the economies of scale. It has the innovative practices. It has the highly skilled workforce, and it has the proximity to markets that give us the resilience we need at this time. There is no room, however, for complacency. We are operating in a fiercely competitive global market. We must continue to innovate and to push for economic reform. With such an approach, I am confident Australia will remain a energy and resources world leader for many years to come. Thank you very much.
Many thanks to Josh Frydenberg for an important address tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. If I repeat anything, it's because I want to make sure that it's that the question is picked up in our pods here and on Channel 648 on APAC. Can we on any topic? No, I think we're going to take. I think we're going to take questions on the general topic of the talk.
Right? Good.
Okay. So I will set off by
childcare or family assistance.
No, those days are past. Can I just lead off? As you know, the government's put a lot of stress lately on innovation, and the impression given is that innovation is something new. But from what you're talking about tonight, I mean, there's obviously been huge amounts of innovation in the mining industry over recent years, and I suppose you could say the same for the rural industry as well. So is it possible to project some of this, of what's happened in, say, the last 10 years in mining and elsewhere into the innovation package, so that Australians don't suddenly think that we're suddenly going to begin to innovate, when in fact, as you know, we've been innovating for about over two centuries here?
Look, it's exactly the right point, which is innovation, and the Prime Minister has underlined this, innovation is something which occurs in new industries, like the startup culture, in technology industries, but also in established industries. And with 10% of the R&D spend in Australia being in the resources and energy space, and I've highlighted some of the practical examples tonight, our companies are very much at the cutting edge. So I don't think it's mutually exclusive to have an innovation policy which provides certain tax breaks for startup companies and a more conducive environment with what is already happening in established industries. One thing Australia can do more of, Gerard, is to seek the collaboration of our tertiary system and our tertiary institutions with our businesses. They do it very well in countries like Germany. It's an area, in the United States. It is something which we could do better here in Australia. And I just want to put in a plug, too, for the CSIRO, because the CSIRO constantly rank within the world's top 1% of scientific institutions. And to that CIRA conference that I attended in Houston just the other week, we had a CSIRO member with us in the delegation, and they are working very closely with industry on practical ways to deal with new technology and to innovate and to implement that and to commercialise that innovation. And one of the particular areas in the energy space, for example, is in unconventional gas, the coal seam gas technology. And one of the things we need to do is convince the public that this is good technology, that it can be done in a scientific and environmentally sustainable way. And that's why groups like the CSIRO are also engaged there.
Okay, so there's a question here. Speak right into it.
Thank you very much, Minister. You said that 50% of Australia's exports are energy-related exports.
Resources, yeah.
Resources. Is this a good thing or is it a bad thing? It's, as an industrialised country like Australia, should it not rely more on other kind of exports than resources exports?
Well, we certainly do. And where, I mean, we've got a huge natural strength in resource and energy exports. And you heard me talk about iron ore, coal, gold, bauxite, nickel, copper. And, of course, gas, and the list goes on. So, of course, with proximity to markets, economies of scale, and a very skilled workforce, we're right to capitalise on that. But what we're seeing now in the region is a greater demand for Australian services. And this is where the free trade agreements with Japan, China, Korea, and ultimately the Trans-Pacific Partnership will really make a difference. Because we have one of the most sophisticated financial services sectors in the world. We have over 400,000 people employed there. We have more than $2 trillion in superannuation funds. We have great skills there to export our financial services. In health, we are really well placed through aged care and hospitals. Groups like Ramsay are very much looking to expand in the region. The number one export out of Victoria is not pharmaceuticals, it's not wine, it's not defence equipment, it's actually education. So there are huge opportunities there. So I think services will be a real growing area for Australian exports, and that as a percentage may grow, and therefore the resources and energy component will come down. But one set of services which is linked to the resource and energy space, which is very interesting, is mining services, mining-related services. Would you believe it's a $90 billion sector in Australia? $90 billion sector in Australia. So when I do meet with these ministers of energy and resources from other countries in the world, they don't just want to talk about the export of the physical, of the actual good itself. They actually want to talk about the export of the services and getting Australian technicians on the ground, teaching them about mine safety or how to drill a well or related services that can be provided. So I think services is a real growing area of the Australian economy, and it's quite a diverse range of services.
Question over there.
Thank you, Minister. Where does the nuclear energy industry fit into our resource planning?
It's a very good question. So Australia has the largest
known recoverable reserves of uranium anywhere in the world. So we have about a third of the world's reserves. Now, 78% of that is in one state, is in South Australia, the vast bulk of which is in Olympic Dam, which I visited just a couple of weeks and went 400 metres underground. Now, we export our uranium to a whole range of countries. The largest market for us is actually the United States. They get around 20% of their energy from nuclear power. In France, it's more than 75%. And we're seeing a massive increase in nuclear power plants construction in countries like India and China, and even countries like Turkey. So it is happening on our doorstep. Now, we, because we've had access to cheap gas and cheap coal, we haven't ever taken the step of developing our own domestic nuclear power industry. And it's something that I raised in my first speech to the Parliament. I said it was quite a curious position we had found ourselves in, where we were happy to export our uranium to the world but not develop it ourselves, particularly given it's a zero emissions technology. So this whole debate has been kicked along by Jay Weatherall, a Labor Premier in South Australia, who commissioned a man called Kevin Scarce, who's the former governor of South Australia and a rear admiral in his former military life, to undertake a royal commission into all aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle. And he did say that Australia should be open to the idea, and South Australia in particular he was talking about, of turning its uranium reserves into nuclear power. He did say that cost was an issue, and obviously scale was an issue, but the technology is developing very quickly. So these new generation reactors can be much smaller in size. They don't have to be near major population centres or near the water. They can actually start to eat their own waste, and they can become quite sophisticated in their technology. So we are now having that conversation as a broader community, and this was an interim report that came out just a few weeks ago. The final report is out in May. But not just the issue of turning uranium into power did the Royal Commission actually talk about. It focused more on Australia taking high-level radioactive waste from other countries and storing it in South Australia, because it identified the fact that this would be a industry which could create more than 5,000 jobs in South Australia and produce, you know, $5 billion worth of income on an annual basis for South Australia. And as you know, South Australia has the highest unemployment in the country, and they are looking for new industries. And this may be one industry that they're prepared to go down the path. They've got stable geology there, and they believe that they perhaps could store the high-level waste. This is very different, I have to emphasise, to low-level and intermediate waste, which Australia currently produces, because we have the Lucas Heights reactor, which produces 10,000 doses of medical-related medicine in this country every week, and one in two people in the community use nuclear medicine over the course of their lifetime. And so that Lucas Heights reactor is producing low-level waste, which is the gloves, the goggles, the hats, the test tubes that come in contact with nuclear medicines, but also the intermediate waste, which are the processed fuel rods from the reactor itself at Lucas Heights. We have an international obligation to store that low-level and intermediate waste. I'm now looking for a single site to store it, because currently it's located around 100 different sites around the country. You might have driven past one of those sites on the way here tonight, and you could be a university, it could be a hospital, it could be Lucas Heights itself. So we're now looking for a site to store this low-level and intermediate waste. But it's very different to the high-level waste, which we don't produce ourselves, which other countries that have nuclear power plants do. And they are looking for a place to store it. And that's what Kevin Scarce's commission has also talked about.
There's a question here. Mr. Robert, just speak into the microphone.
Oh, nice to see you, Robert.
That specific question about nuclear power prompts me to raise a more broad question for you. That is, would you like to comment on how the undertakings made by the Australian government at the Paris conference, COP21, might in future affect the further development of the Australian resources and energy sector?
Question about the impact of Paris on the Australian resources sector.
It's a very good question. In fact, I gave a speech at the Brookings Institute just a couple of weeks ago in Washington about Australia's commitment to reduce its carbon emissions and how that would impact on the sector. So it's a topic I'm quite familiar with. Australia, so everyone who doesn't know knows, we said that we would reduce our emissions by 26 to 28%. On 2005 levels by 2030. That was the target we took to Paris. Now, that would mean a reduction in emissions per capita basis, which was the second highest in the world, only behind Brazil. So it was a pretty ambitious target. Now, we think we can get there a number of ways. We think we can get there through the Emissions Reduction Fund, which is a market-based mechanism where we go out and seek the highest, the lowest cost abatement, where we seek people who are producing emissions, and we say to them, if you reduce it below business as usual, we'll pay you to do that. We have energy efficiency mechanisms. We have the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. We're commercialising renewable technologies, and we have our renewable energy target. Currently, we produce 15% of our energy from renewable means, and we get to 23.5% by 2020. So we think we can do all of that. What, though, is happening globally is that there's an energy mix switch, and there is a switch away from coal towards renewables and an increase towards gas, because gas is a cleaner form of fossil fuel, effectively. And this will impact upon the demand for Australia's resources. The only fossil fuel that will increase as a percentage of the overall energy mix between now and 2040 is gas. And so Australia will find very lucrative markets for our gas exports. Coal is a different story. 40% of the world's electricity in today comes from coal. By 2040, 40% falls down to 30%, according to the IEA. So it's still very significant. But if you look at China, if you look at Japan, if you look at the EU, they are all reducing. If you look at the United States, they're all reducing their dependence on coal. I mention India because India is increasing its consumption of coal, as well as renewables, because it just has so many people who need access to electricity. So I'm prepared to defend the coal sector because Australia's coal is low in sulphur, low in ash, and it's a cleaner form of coal than in other countries. It's being used in what are called high-efficiency, low-emission power plants, HELE power plants throughout Asia, which can reduce the carbon emissions by up to 40% on the older plants. And it's such a big export earner for Australia. So I'm not going to sell out. You know, good companies and good industries that are helping to remove people from energy poverty throughout the world. But I do acknowledge that the reliance on coal globally is coming down as a percentage of the overall energy mix, and this will impact upon Australia and our future export earnings. At the same time, we're well placed with gas, where the demand will increase substantially in the years ahead.
There's a question here. Don't stand.
Minister, you stress the enormous opportunities in India and China. Have you considered how Indonesia might fit into this? Because that's another country which is very close to us, fourth largest population in the world, growing quite quickly now, about 6%. Do you see opportunities there too?
Absolutely. And Minister Saeed, my equivalent, was out here just a few weeks ago too. We have become the largest exporter of coal in the last few months, overtaking Indonesia. And Indonesia has diverted more of its coal production towards domestic use to meet the very demand that you're referring to as their economy strengthens. We have a large number of companies, as you know, that are active in the resource space in Indonesia. So I think there are very good opportunities there. There's very good opportunities around the mining services in particular. And so we are helping to cooperate there. But the free trade agreements, the people-to-people links, the fact that companies can freely invest in Indonesia and the good political relationship we have between our two countries would indicate that there are good export opportunities.
Minister, first, thank you for your speech. It's great to have you as advocate on behalf of the Minerals Council for the industry. Can I ask you about your perception of the resilience of our foreign investment framework? I mean, I think we've seen probably, I mean, the government's obviously had a general openness framework, but we have seen sensitivities in areas like agriculture and real estate and various changes made. Given the sort of current state in the mining sector, there's always a potential, I guess, for a wave of selling of assets, and obviously Chinese capital figures in that. Do you have a sense that our framework and I guess community confidence in that framework is at a level that allows us to sort of cope with that eventuality if it happens?
Well, let me make a couple of points just about the resources, foreign investment in the resource and energy space, and then maybe separate that out from just a comment more broadly about foreign investment. If you look at the history of the Australian resources and energy sectors, we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are today if it wasn't for foreign investment. That has been huge Japanese investment, huge American and Dutch investment, and English investment, and now considerable Chinese investment. I referred to the $70 billion Gorgon project. Chevron is the number one shareholder, just under 50%, and the two 25% stakes are Shell and ExxonMobil. This project is the largest ever investment for these companies anywhere in the world. I mean, people fail to understand. When I meet with the head of Shell, he tells me now that the Shell and the BG Group have come together under the Shell banner, that Australia is its biggest presence anywhere in the world. Just yesterday, I met with the chairman of Mitsubishi from Japan, the global chairman of Japan. Mitsubishi is a massive conglomerate. And he just re-emphasised to me, because they've just celebrated 60 years in their relationship with Australia, how important Australia is to their company's prospects. Out there in Vodaland, people don't necessarily appreciate how important Australia is to these multinationals. And I'd go as far to say there's no other industry that Australia is involved in, agriculture or property or financial services, that comes close to Australia's dominant global position as it is in resources and energy. So I think you will continue to see massive investment from overseas in the Australian resources sector. But obviously, with prices coming down, that resource investment will slow because, you know, the returns are not necessarily there today, but they will be there over the medium and longer term. On the broader issue, there has been some legitimate issues raised by the public about foreign investment. They've raised questions about the transparency of that investment. So, for example, keeping registers of agricultural land that is sold to foreign owners. They've had concerns about the size of the investments that can be made without receiving FIRB approval. You've noticed all the controversy over the Darwin port being sold to Landbridge. The legitimate issues were raised about did that go through FIRB approval, or because it was a state-owned or territory-owned asset that it didn't necessarily have to go through the formal process. Well, now we've changed that. There have been legitimate questions about who is on the FIRB board, and we've just placed David Irvine, for example, a former head of ASIO, ASIS, and Australia's ambassador to China, to give more of a strategic focus to FIRB decisions. So we have taken steps at a number of levels, John, to try to bring more rigour to the FIRB process. But our starting position is unequivocally we welcome, we need, we want, we seek foreign investment in this country. It's an unequivocal message. We're a country of 24 million people. Indonesia, what is 250 million people. Japan is 130 million people plus. China and India, 1.2, 1.3 billion people. These are huge, huge economies on our doorstep. And if we are to develop and to benefit from our natural endowments, whatever the sector, we do need that foreign investment.
Many thanks, Minister. I think that's a good question and answer to end up on. There are more questions here, but we're right on 7 o'clock, so I think at that stage I should say thank you. Thank you also to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this facility. It's been a great presentation tonight. I mean, we're used to Josh Frydenberg, the polemicist, arguing the case on Q&A and with other troublesome...
Outnumbered.
Outnumbered. It's normally 3-2, but I think last night it was 5-1. I might have been 6-1. I lost count. But we're used to Josh Frydenberg, the polemicist. But tonight we've had Josh Frydenberg, the considered minister, reflecting on the mineral industry, the resources industry, but also with a great historical background to it. Because as we know, Australia's wealth was built on the basis of its minerals and its rural exports over 200 years, and you've acknowledged that tonight. Acknowledged the continuing importance of the mineral and resources industries whilst looking at the various problems which the industries face. So that's an important address tonight. We'll love to have you back sometime in the future, either as the Minister polemicist or the Minister considered analyst, but tonight we've had the latter one, and last night we had a bit of the former one, so well done and thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening. We hope you enjoyed joining us again soon.